Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Fall, my co-host. Desiree is on holiday this weekend. This is podcast number 252, February 9th, 2008. Steven?
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads that interest you. From face cream to car cream, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them, you know you want to.
Keep up the good work, Steven. And of course, thank you, Yahoo Ads. And welcome to this special edition of F1Weekly.com. We call it the interview of interviews. Nas, introduce us this fantastic man who's contributed so much to our lives.
Clark, this conversation took place last Saturday in beautiful Black Hawk, California with Harden Ganley. And what a story this is. He left his native country, New Zealand. He raced it a little bit with only $50. And he was telling me about his journey. You know, he went on a ship through Suez Canal, landed in Lisbon, took a bus to London. And he had one thing on his mind, to become a Formula One racing driver. And he was a mechanic. He worked for McLaren. He was crew chief to Peter Revson, did some Formula 3 in England, then made it to Formula One. And then he also started a car company, Tiga Racing Cars, you'll probably remember, with Tim Shenkin. And his wife, unfortunately, passed away last year, Judy, and she was quite a known figure in motor racing also. She used to drive race cars also, and I think it was the 1970 Sebring, she was first in her class in an all-female crew. Very impressive. And then she was very well known in the timing and scoring arena of Formula One circuit. So I went to his house. I would like to thank him very much for inviting me, and we sat down and just talked nothing but motor racing. And I hope our listeners enjoy this conversation, and thank you again, sir.
Okay, I'm here in beautiful Black Hawk with a gentleman from New Zealand, Mr. Harden Ganley. Mr. Ganley, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I probably should be out playing golf, but as you can see, it's raining like crazy, so I'm not going out.
Okay, let me take you back in time to your native country, a place called Ardmore, 1955. You were there as a teenager. Please tell us what you remember from that day, and was that the race that sparked your interest in motor racing?
Yeah, definitely. I didn't really have any interest up to that point. I was interested in sailing, and we lived on the edge of a lake in Hamilton, and I sailed most weekends all through summer. I guess we were off at the beach house. My father was going to Ardmore and my brother was going, and so I thought, well, I'll just tag along and see what it looks like. And when those Grand Prix cars came around the corner for the first time, I was just flipped my life. Yeah, it was just so fantastic. I thought, by the end of the day, I said, oh, forget the sailing, I'm going to be a Grand Prix driver.
Now, in that race, do you remember anything? Were there some drivers who made it to Formula One?
Well, there had been in Formula One, because Prince Bira in the 250F, he won the race. And, of course, that made me a 250F Maserati fan straight away, because I thought it was the most beautiful car. Tony Gaze was there in a Ferrari, and Peter Whitehead was also in a Ferrari. Jack Brabham at that stage hadn't come to Grand Prix, but he was driving a Cooper Bristol pretty energetically, and he's one who certainly did. And that would be the standout one, of course, three-time world champion, and he hadn't even been to Europe at that stage.
Now, in those days, how would you follow Formula One racing, living so far away from Europe?
Well, my father subscribed to Motorsport magazine, and so, of course, after that, I started looking at his magazines, and I mean, they had that beautiful colour, that supplement, photographic supplement in the centre. And so I learned about Fangio and everybody. But I think the New Zealand newspapers, once the New Zealand Grand Prix had started in 1954, then they took much more of an interest in motor racing. So you got the race reports, pretty brief ones, but there was a lot in the newspapers about it.
Did you have any racing heroes growing up once the racing bug got to you? And any particular race or driver that stands out while you were a teenager?
Well, Stirling Moss became my instant hero, I guess, because of 1955, and then he just signed with Mercedes, and then I started reading about him. And he was of an age that I could identify with, perhaps more than some of the older guys like Fangio, although of course I recognise that Fangio was the absolute master. And while I was at school then, I wrote to Sterling and I got an autograph photograph from him, which I still have. And I followed his career. And then I was given Stirling Moss's book of motorsport, which came out in 1955. And I must have read it about 100 times in that first year. So, yeah, he would be my first hero in motor racing. And it's so lovely now to know him.
How long was your career as a motorsport journalist, and how much fun was interviewing racing drivers?
Well, my journalistic career at that stage was extremely short because I left school, I guess, when I was 16, and I got a job in the local newspaper. Of course, all I wanted to do was write about motor racing. But I only worked there for 2 years, and I was, as well as writing stuff for the newspaper, I was submitting articles to, in fact, I had, before I left school, been submitting articles to various magazines. And then when I came to England and worked as a mechanic, I continued to send stories back to magazines in Australia and New Zealand. So I suppose you could say I had a 4 or 5 year career as a motor racing journalist, and I'm just trying to start it up again.
Did you interview any of the famous drivers of your time?
I was much too shy to interview anybody. No, I didn't.
Okay, you talk about England in 1961. You were sailing there loaded with $50, from what I understand. Please tell us about this journey and what kind of dreams were you harboring at this stage of your life?
Well, I had by that stage done some racing in New Zealand on an absolute shoestring. And it was actually 1962 that I set off for England after the season finished, 61-62 season finished. I set off for England on an old ship, and I arrived there just before Easter 1962 to go to Goodwood, and unfortunately that's where my hero Sterling had his accident.
Your initial foray into motor racing was through preparing cars for others. How important is the interaction between the crew and the driver in setting up a car?
Oh, well, it's absolutely vital. I was, actually I should go back on the previous question and say, I was coming to England to be a Grand Prix driver. In fact, I only had $50, was a slight deterrent, but just another hurdle, really. I was very fortunate that eventually, in order to make some money, had to become a mechanic, and I learned an awful lot. And so it made me appreciate just how important it is that the driver gets on with the engineer or can communicate with the engineer, and then the mechanics are very supportive of the driver and want to do a lot for him. And I became that way when I was a mechanic. I was totally supportive of what I considered my driver, our driver. And Peter Revson and Chris Amon would be the two classic examples, I guess. Guys that I mechanic for and thought got on well with, and really wanted to do everything I could to make their car better.
Talking of Chris Amon, he's also from New Zealand. Are you in touch with him?
Yes, I had lunch with him about 3 weeks ago.
Does he ever come to the US?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Okay, but he's doing well.
Oh, he's very well, yeah. He seems pretty fit, and I think he's enjoying life.
Okay. Would you agree that what some say now, that driver played a bigger role in winning than the machine in the early days, 60s and 70s?
Well, certainly the engineers have become much more important in recent years because of all the telemetry and everything, and they can see what the car is doing. They don't have to solely rely on what the driver is telling him. If we go back into previous years, say even in my era, all that could happen was that you had to come in and tell the engineer or the chief mechanic, more often than not, or the designer, what you thought the car was doing. And if you were wrong, then you were sending him off in the wrong direction. Now, of course, the telemetry enables the engineers to see what's really happening.
Bruce McLaren, also from New Zealand, a name synonymous with motor racing. You worked for him. When was the first time you met him?
Oh, I'd met him when I was racing in New Zealand in 1961, I guess it would be. And I already knew him when I came to England. But I didn't immediately go and work for him. I messed around and did other things and tried to get into racing by other methods. And then things had all sort of come to a bit of a halt. And one day he called me up and offered me a job because he was going to expand his team.
How was he as a person? We know about him as a race car driver and an excellent engineer. Anything you can tell us that most racing fans would not know about Bruce? Something positive, of course.
Oh, he was just one of the nicest guys that you could ever meet. And, yeah, I mean, he had a great sense of humor. He was a terrific leader of men. And I think everybody who worked for him just would do absolutely anything for Bruce. And Bruce used to come into the workshop in the morning and he'd go around and say good morning to everybody and look at what you were doing. And he really lifted everybody. You couldn't find a nicer guy, really.
Do you remember where you were and how you got the news when he was killed?
People always talk about, I remember what I was doing or where I was when John Kennedy was shot. I remember absolutely vividly where I was and what I was doing when I got the phone call about Bruce. We had actually planned to go testing with the Formula 5000 car that day because, you know, he put me into the works car. And but I was back at my own workshop from where I ran my gearbox business, and the phone rang, and it was Barry Newman telling me the news. I just couldn't take it in.
Are you still in touch with members of his family?
Yes, I see Amanda, his daughter, every so often. I see his wife, Patty, from time to time. And having just been in New Zealand, I've seen his sister, Jan, as well.
Everybody doing well?
They all seem pretty good, as far as I can see.
That's good. You mentioned Peter Revson, right? You were his crew chief, I believe, in 1966. How would you rate him as a driver?
Oh, I certainly thought that he was going to go a long way. I'd seen him. I had actually met him when he was over in Europe doing the Formula One in his first go at it with Tim Parnell. And, then when I came to work for him, I could see, I thought he would certainly get to Formula One. He had that ability. He was going to get there. But, of course, it took him quite a lot longer, from 1966, I think, until, end of 71, he had his first drive with Tyrrell, if I'm right, and then went to McLaren's in 72.
Given his profession and connection to cosmetic company, was he really a ladies' man as per the reputation?
Well, I was only his mechanic, so I don't know. But he sure was a good-looking guy, and how much money he had was another matter. I don't know, but for sure, he must have been able to attract some very good-looking ladies.
Yeah, that's what I hear all the time. 1967, you were driving a Brabham BT21 in British Formula 3. Were you the driver, entrant, and sponsor?
Yes, I had, through working for McLaren's and then being seconded to Ford and then working for Peter Revson, I'd finally saved up enough money to buy a brand new BT21. But I didn't have a lot of extra money once I'd bought all the equipment, and I had to keep going to Europe where I could get starting money and prize money. And then I'd come back, when I had gathered a little bit of that, I could come back to England and do a British Formula 3 race, because you didn't get any starting money or no worthwhile prize money in those. And then I'd go back to Europe and earn a bit more money there, and then I'd come back to England and do it. That's why I didn't do a great number of British Formula 3 races.
Going from preparing cars to driving them, what was the biggest surprise or challenge for you?
Well, of course, I'd started racing a long time before in my mother's Morris Minor. Biggest challenge is really just being fast enough. I always imagined that I would be able to do it, but of course these things always look easy when you're watching over the fence. So it was just a gradual evolution, and I don't think anything ever surprised me greatly.
Now, talking about speed, when somebody gets into motor racing, the speed you have is the speed you keep, or a driver can learn how to go fast?
Yeah, I think you can learn to go fast. Perhaps Graham Hill is one of the world's greatest examples. You become accustomed to speed, and well, it's a bit like, you know, people you see on the highway. They get used to going down the highway at 70 mile an hour. When all the traffic comes to a halt, they don't realize how much it's slowed down. And you get that way in racing. You at Le Mans, for example, I always said that you go down that the Mulsanne straight. In those days when I raced, they didn't have any chicanes. And after a while, it seems so slow. You think you could get out and walk alongside the car because everything becomes slow motion for you.
Who were some of the drivers you raced against in Formula 3?
Ronnie Peterson, Rainer Vassell, Francois Savaire, Tim Shanken, they would be, or Emerson Fittipaldi. The guys that all came into Formula 1 at about the same time in 1970-71.
Did you race against Jochen Rindt also?
Well, yes, I did. I guess I did a couple of Formula 2 races in 1970, and I had actually been in a Formula Junior race in 1963 at Nürburgring, which is the first time I think a lot of us became aware of Jochen. I remember he crashed in practice and broke his nose. But, yeah, so I knew of him, and then when he turned up at Crystal Palace that time and beat everybody, I actually knew who he was.
You know, the reason I asked is I started following Formula One in 73, and he was deceased by then, and I used to read a lot about him. And even when you read his widow, Nina's, like, remembrance of him, she says, you know, he was a difficult man to get along. A lot of journalists call him arrogant. Did you get to know him, and how did you find him as a person?
Well, I knew him a bit because I had, for one race, mechanicked at Winkelmann Racing, and Alan and Jochen were good friends, and I used to be around the Winkelmann workshop a bit. So, and Jochen was in and out of there, so I got to know him there. And, in fact, at the end of 1969, he asked to see me and discuss whether I would, if I went to Team Lotus for Formula 3, then... he said, I'd probably finish up in his Formula 2 team. So, yes, I don't think I knew him very well, but I knew him enough as a friend to talk to.
He was okay to deal with as far as you are concerned?
Well, he was, yeah, I can understand why people might think that Jochen was awkward. He had a manner about him, but I think underneath he was fine. So, you know, but I was... dealing with him or meeting with him in a different relationship. I wasn't his team owner, so it was a much easier friendship, if you like.
In those days, drivers were not only competitors but also good friends. Rindt and Stewart, a good example. Did you develop personal friendship with some of your drivers, including Formula 3 and Formula 1?
Well, Tim Shanken and I became quite good friends. We met in... then 67 when we were both doing 1000cc Formula 3, and we just seemed to get on well with each other, and eventually we bought a house together and our careers followed very similar paths. And then later on, of course, we started Tiger Race Cars, racing cars, and but at the same time I became quite good friends with Rainer Vassell because he spoke good English. I didn't speak any Swedish until later when I had a Swedish girlfriend. But and then Ronnie Peterson a little bit, but Ronnie was a little bit shy, and I became sort of friends with Francois really when we drove together in at Le Mans for Matra. I don't think I ever became particular friends with Emerson. I mean, I knew him and say hello to him and all the rest of it, friendly enough, but yeah, Tim was probably the outstanding one.
How was Severo, a real good-looking guy like Refson? How was he to deal with?
Oh, Francois was a wonderful guy, yeah. He was so intelligent, great sense of humor again, and, we got on well together. So it was devastating when he had his accident at Watkins Glen. That really knocked me for quite a bit, for six. But, yeah, you could see why Francois could attract the ladies. He had everything going for him.
And how was my man, Ronnie? I was a huge Ronnie Peterson fan. How was he as a person?
Oh, well, Ronnie was very laid back. he was two different guys, Ronnie. You know, he was sort of just Mr. Average, friendly, laid-back guy out of the car. And when he got in the car, he had all that wonderful car control and balance, and he was fantastic.
Of the drivers you raced throughout your career, who were the drivers you thought were really good, especially guys who did not end up winning world championship, because a lot of time good drivers don't get the right breaks?
Well, the outstanding example for me was Chris Amon. And that, as I saw it, he was the one guy at that time, possibly plus Dan Gurney, but Chris could go head-to-head with Jim Clark and beat him. And then somehow, amazingly, it just didn't go right. But he was outstanding. And, of course, of the others, you will think, wow, these guys are all pretty good. They're hard to beat.
1970, driving a privately entered McLaren M10, you were second in the British Formula 5000 Championship with 10 podium finishes. What was the highlight of the season for you? And were you frustrated that you did not win a race?
Well, yes, you probably read that I didn't win a race, but that's not true. I won at Alton Park. And I did win one of the heats at Castle Coombe. I don't know why it's gone down in history, as I didn't ever win one of the championship rounds. Well, that was a big break for me, because Bruce McLaren gave me a Formula One test at the end of 69. And after the test, he said, right, I'm going to put you into Formula One in a year's time, but I want you to do a season of Formula 5000 racing. And so it was effectively a works car, but the running costs were provided by Bruce's next door neighbour, Barry Newman. And we did 18 races. I think we finished 16 and were never lower than fourth. It was the European Championship, actually, not the British Championship. And I suppose the highlight, setting the new lap record at Castle Coombe, which stood for goodness knows how long, many, many years, and in that dice with Peter Gethin. Pole position at Anderstorp, and the way we did it, we'd just go out, do a warm-up lap, and do a time, and then come and sit. But I suppose in the end, winning at the 5000 part of the Gold Cup was the most memorable, because then I got to ride around on the victory lap on the wagon with John Surtees, who'd won the Formula One section. And of course I was very shy, and then sort of tugging my forelock and saying, oh, hello, Mr. Surtees. But later on, as I've come to know John, I think he's a great bloke as well.
You mentioned Anderstorp in Sweden. You know, I took a trip there last September because I wanted to see Ronnie's home track. I've never seen so many trees in my life. How did you find the place and the track back in those days?
I mean, how do we physically find it?
No, in terms of, did you like the track? I mean, out in the boonies?
I liked the track. I went there first, one of the first ever races they held there in Formula 3 in 1968, and then I went back in 69 in Formula 3, and then 1970 in Formula 5000. And I discovered that if you really attacked those corners, they had slightly banked corners,
Yeah. You
could get a good time. So, it was a track that suited me.
You were second at Monza, and I hope I have this information correct. How special is that place for a driver, and what was it like without the chicanes?
Well, when I went there in Formula 5000, which I guess is what you're referring to, the
right.
Second place, yeah. And we were sort of walking wounded at the end, but I didn't find it terribly interesting because you just drone down those long straights. When we went back there the following year in Formula 1, and then there was the multi-car dices, then that was really pretty exciting, a lot more enjoyable, and you just drove the thing as hard as it would go, whereas in Formula 5000 you always try to nurse the engine along because of the heat, and the Chevy engine used to overheat and then it would crack the cylinder heads, so you had to be careful, and you weren't going flat out.
You finally arrived in Formula 1 in 1971, 10 years after sailing from New Zealand. Please tell us some behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing that brought you to the house of PRM.
Well, having had the second place in the Formula 5000 championship. Didn't seem like a good idea to go any further. And BRM were having a bit of a driver shuffle. I very nearly went to March, but apparently Bruce McLaren had mentioned me to Louis Stanley, and Barry Newman was a good old entrepreneur. And so he talked to Louis Stanley about me, and I actually went there really as the number four driver, just to see how I went. John Miles was taken on. So then John and I were to do the non-championship races, so I was going to be really a bit of a dog's body at the end. But fortunately, then I had a couple of good races, and all of a sudden I was the number three driver. And of course, they were running three cars full time.
Now, Louis Stanley was quite a character. Somebody said of him recently in a magazine, actually in Motorsport, that he thought he was Enzo Ferrari of England. And Niki Lauda also had a few things to say about him. How did you find him as a person and team owner?
Yeah, I think he did I say he was the Enzo Ferrari of Britain? That's something that I've always thought. BRM were really the Ferrari of Great Britain. That they were the ones who made their own engines, gearboxes, everything. And so they were a fully fledged constructor. Louis Stanley was a bit of a mixed bag. He was not the easiest guy to drive for, and you could go in and out of favour. I was never quite sure why. And so eventually I decided I couldn't stay there any longer, and after 2 years I then moved on. Whereas he'd offered me a very good drive for 73, but I thought, no, I need to change teams here. So we parted probably not on the best of terms. But then when I had my accident in 74, he was just fantastic. He got both myself and Mike Hailwood out of the Krankenhaus in Germany, and got us flown back to England and got us into St. Thomas's, and got the best man, Mr. Urquhart, who had looked after John Surtees and Stirling when they had their accidents, and he was looking after us. And really, Big Lou couldn't have done more for us. He was just terrific.
Good to hear that. Now, it was around this time you met a Stanford-educated racer and a lady who became your wife, and sadly, Judy passed away last April. Will you please share with us some remembrance of her and where you first met her?
Yeah. In 1971, I had a call from Patty McLaren telling me that she had this very good friend coming over to stay with her for a while, and they were going to come to the races because Patty was still the team owner or whatever portion of the team she owned then. And she said, I really want you to meet her. And I wasn't that interested because I figured I was well equipped with girlfriends. So eventually Patty kept chasing me up, and at the Spanish Grand Prix I went up to the McLaren compound and I met this lady. But that was it, we just met. And then I came to Riverside at the end of that season to drive the Can-Am car, BRM Can-Am car, and this very nice lady came up and started talking to me, and I realized it was the same lady from Barcelona. And anyway, a night or so later, with a bit of prompting from Jackie Oliver and his wife, then wife Lynn, I took Judy out to dinner, and our relationship just developed from there. And you know, I'm just so lucky that I married her eventually. I mean, it took a little while, a few humps and bumps, but we were married in 1975, so we're married nearly 32 years, and I could never have found a better wife. She was words kind of fail me, really. She was so fantastic. She was so talented. She could do absolutely everything, and she was just a beautiful human being.
I've seen her in videos of, especially at Monaco Grand Prix, working the stopwatch. She was quite an expert on timing and scoring, right?
She was very, well, she could do absolutely anything. She had a very high IQ. She was a member of Mensa, you know, for those high IQ people. And, yeah, she could time a huge number of cars on one watch, and she could do a lap chart. And I've seen her at least twice do the whole of the Le Mans 24-hour, never get off the stand, sit there and do a lap chart. And now, what concentration does that take? And so, yeah, she was a great timer, timekeeper, and a great lap charter. And I reckon her lap charter, the 73 Canadian Grand Prix, is the right one.
Yeah, that's coming up in my next questions. 1971 Italian Grand Prix. I was talking to a friend of mine last year, I think, and he asked me a question. He said, of all the races run in the history of motor racing, Grand Prix motor racing, if you could go back in time, what race would you want to be at? And I said, instantly, Monza 71, and you were in that race. Tell us about that event, please.
Well, I'd qualified on the second row. According to several watches, I had a time that was much quicker, but which would have put me on pole. And I was complaining to Tim Parnell when the times came out. I said, get up there and sort that out, Tim, because you got all the times and the other team had it anyway. He said, no, no, chap, you'll be all right. Anyway, and he turned, that was good advice, because when I thought the chap had been holding the flag up for long enough, I just dropped the clutch. As I was going through between the two guys on the front row, which was X and Eamon, I thought, oh dear, I've jumped the start by too much, I'll be penalised. And at that moment, Clay Regazzoni came past me from the fourth row. So I figured, well, I'm dead safe now, because if they can't get me without getting Clay, and they're not going to penalise Clay. So then off we went, and, you know, we were slipstreaming away. Unfortunately, my engine deteriorated somewhat. I kept trying to keep it as cool as possible, but I don't know what was going wrong with it. And so I was clinging onto the back there. Then I lost the rear brakes and nearly had a couple of accidents. So that was a bit frustrating. And at the end, I thought, well, these guys, the other four, because the pace got slower and slower and slower, and I could see this BRM coming up behind, and I thought it was Joe Siffert. And I'd fallen out of the leading bunch at one point earlier on in the race, and Joe came along and towed me back up to them. So I thought, well, there's no way I can win because my engine's basically gone here. So what I should do is try and drag Joe up into the leading group because, you know, he's catching up. His engine's okay. He'd had a bit of a gearbox problem earlier on. So I dropped as far back off the group, the other four, as I could go. So to give a tow, because, you know, you can tow from 200 yards back. And so I helped to drag this BRM. I was somewhat surprised when the BRM arrived, and it wasn't Joe, it was Peter Gethin. So, you know, all I'd done is sort of cost myself. If the pace had kept up, I guess I'd have been at least fourth. By dragging Peter up, I pushed myself back down a place, which is a pity, but whatever. I thought they would all run into each other at the last corner. So I was on the power way early, and they were bouncing off each other, but then they just accelerated me.
Yeah, I was reading, this was Peter Gethin's first and only win, and some years ago I was reading his interview, and he said, you know, it was so close that intentionally he raised his hand before the checkered flag, so, you know, this being Italy, he thought they'll think, you know, this guy won. Was that the most exciting race you were ever in?
It was certainly one of. Maybe the Canadian Grand Prix had some merit there as well. My former three race at Brands Hatch in 1969 was probably the most exciting. I think the excitement for me at Monza, unfortunately, was diluted by the fact my engine had deteriorated, or even, you know, if the brakes had stayed up, I might have been a dive down and kind of muscle my way through on the inside. So, yeah, it was tempered by that little problem.
Now, every time there's a race, Formula One race at Monza, they talk about the passions of the Tifosis and all that, and I've experienced that as a spectator there a few times. As a driver, do you ever pay any attention to these things?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you're aware of it, or other people maybe are wound up by it, but it certainly has a terrific atmosphere, but then so do a lot of races. Silverstone used to as well, probably still does. As I wasn't probably one of the Tifosi's favourite guys, it didn't make any difference to me, I don't think.
How was the experience driving with Sever and finishing second at Le Mans? And I believe you were leading at one stage when you were hit from behind.
Yeah, it looked as though we were going to win. I mean, driving with Francois was terrific. We got on well. I wasn't. He was worried that I was going to come and try and go faster than he was, and I said, "No, we're going to do this properly and cruise along at our set speed, and there's no egos here," which actually then sorted it out between us. And driving for Matra was just fantastic. They were such a great team. So that was a wonderful experience. And yes, if you look up the Jabby Krombach book, we basically led for 20 hours, I think it was. And at some point, because I'd remembered the McLaren Ken Miles situation at Le Mans, you know, in 1966. Oh, yeah. So I said to the to Duca Rouge and to Lagardère at some point in the night, you know, what's going to happen here? Who's going to win? And they said, "Oh, don't worry about it, because you guys are using so much less brake pad and less fuel that you're just gradually easing away from the other car. So it's, you know, you're going to win it. We don't need to mess around with team orders." So okay, I was happy with that result. And then of course, we got the water in the ignition, and then had to stop, I think twice, three times, to try to get that sorted out. By which time we were had lost our lead, and so we were in second place. And I just caught up to Graham then, after sorting the problem out, when he ran into that rainstorm, and he just disappeared into the wall of water. And I was only on intermediate, so I thought, well, there's a problem. So I had to lift off, and I was going as quick as I could. But the Corvette, presumably on rain tyres and much heavier, cutting through the water, just ran straight in the back of me. And I was over on the right-hand side of the straight. I wasn't in the middle of the road or anything.
What's it like going at 200 miles per hour, 2 in the morning at Mulsanne?
See, as I said before, it seems relatively slow. It doesn't seem anything special, no.
Now, everybody talks about the Matra V12 engine. Was that a special sound?
Yeah, fantastic sound. Yeah, it was. Well, I think any V12 is going to have a sound like that. The Matra was great. I think the Westlake Eagle was. The BRM had a different exhaust system of those megaphones, which gave it a slightly throatier sound. So it didn't scream like the Matra. Yeah, the Matra was beautiful noise.
You mentioned a couple of, I'm a big Matra fan. Jean-Luc Lagardère is the gentleman who brought Matra into motor racing, and Gérard Duca Rouge. How did you find these two people dealing with them?
Well, Gérard Duca Rouge, I thought, was a fantastic bloke. I mean, he did, nothing was left to chance with Gérard, and because he'd been, I guess, in the aerospace industry, and I came in and joined up with the team when we started doing the 24-hour tests. We did 3 24-hour tests at Paul Ricard, because the first one, it didn't go far enough. The second one, it just about went far enough, so I went back and did a third one. And then, and I saw how thorough he was. Nothing was left to chance. He was terrific. And, Jean-Luc Lagardère, I didn't have a great deal to do with him. I talked to him from time to time at the testing. He was pretty hands-on, taking an interest in what was going on. And I saw him immediately after the race, and he said to me, "Nothing to blame, nothing to blame." He didn't tell me, "Not my fault, I was run into." But he said, "For you next year." And at that stage, of course, we were all going to go next year. But then the rules changed, and whatever happened, suddenly all the Rosbifs and the Kiwis had to leave.
Now, sports car racing was very big in those days. A lot of Formula One drivers would go there. You were there. Did you enjoy sports car racing as much as Formula One?
Well, I always thought that I was a single-seater guy, and that's what I should do, and that was my love. But then I got to drive sports cars, and with the Matra, and then with the Mirage, and then with the Can-Am car, I thought was fantastic. Loved that. And even the little 2-liter Chevron, I drove that at Kyalami in 71, and then again at Nürburgring in 72. So yeah, I just kind of got on with sports cars, although I thought I was a Formula One driver.
Frank Williams was your team owner in 1973, and like I said, this was the year I started following racing and the Dutch Grand Prix, tragic Dutch Grand Prix. Yeah. A couple of things. We interviewed Hees van Lennep, and I think he is the one who gave Frank Williams the first World Championship point. I asked him about this race where Williamson was killed, and that none of the drivers stopped apart from David Purley. And he said to me, and I've read this many times, that most of the drivers thought that the David Purley, it was his car, so nobody even thought the driver was trapped inside. Your thoughts, and what do you remember from that race?
Have you read The Lost Generation?
Not yet.
I have written a piece for my own book, and I gave it to David Tremaine because I think it summed up my feeling, yes. Well, you're going around there, and there's a car on fire, but there's nobody doing anything about it, and there's a big fire engine, there was a big fire engine just up the road, right. And so the natural feeling is, well, it's not like there's a whole bunch of marshals running about, and the fire engine's not coming and nothing, so there can't be anybody trapped in the car, because they wouldn't just leave it like that, would they? That's the logical conclusion. Had they red flagged the race and everybody had stopped, there had been a bunch of guys with Nomex and helmets on, they'd have flipped the car over and dragged Roger out of it. Which, I mean, a terrible indictment of the whoever was running the race. And it was absolutely devastating when we came back in, and Judy said to me, "Did you know Roger Williamson was in the car?" I just couldn't believe it.
Okay, now this next race you've brought up already, the chaotic 73 Canadian Grand Prix, and you can see videos that some of the team members are urging you to go and claim the prize because you were the winner, or they were thought you were the winner. What do you have to say about that race?
Well, Judy did a lap chart, and she had me there, although she did concede there's a blip, and perhaps Emerson had got in front of me. But he was the only one. Of course, we hadn't been going particularly well all season, but at this race, the ambient was very low, very cold day because it had rained when we were on the warm up lap, and I thought, I remember the Canadian Grand Prix. I think it was from '67 when Bruce nearly won in the M5 McLaren. And it had dried out, and I thought, it's not going to keep raining, it'll dry out, because I know it's done it before. So I didn't mess my car around. Some people have put soft springs, and they disconnect the anti-roll bars, and they crank a load of wing into it, and they do all those things for a wet race, which you naturally do. So anyway, I stayed out longer than everybody else, according to our chart. The official chart has me stopping much sooner. And I wasn't going to stop, until Tim Schenken and the other car had stopped, so the guys had a practice pit stop because nobody had ever practiced that before. And also, I wasn't going to come in while the pit lane was full of cars because it was a really narrow little pit lane, short pits. During practice, it was a real traffic jam in there. So I thought, you've got to wait till everybody else has done it. Of course, then I'm staying out there a bit longer than I really wanted to, driving around trying to find wet patches to keep the tyres cold. So we made a terrific stop. And when I went out again and then came to the pace car and they grabbed me, I thought I had dropped out of the lead while I was in the pits, but perhaps I hadn't. Anyway, so then on we went, and eventually Revson caught up to me, but he didn't get past. I fended him off. When we came to the finish, the checkered flags waved. So has it been waved for me, or is it for Revson or Hunt, who's, I can see him some way back in the mirror. So I did one more lap flat out, just to make sure, and came in, and they said, "Yeah, you won." And I'm thinking, I'm not sure, maybe third. And for sure, that's the alternatives on Judy's chart. But when they wanted, some of the teams went up to the tower, obviously, with their charts, didn't want to know about Judy's. It's probably the most accurate one of them all. And so they said, "Oh, well, okay, you can be sixth," which I thought, I was really penalised for that. So and they put Jackie Stewart in front of me. Well, I know that Jackie had been into the pits and it was too crowded, so Ken waved him out again. Then he came back, and then it fell off the jack. And there's no way he could have been in front of me. That was ridiculous. But anyway, I think what they did in the end, that they took a bunch of people that they knew were still running. They decided on who was the most famous one, maybe if they'd raced there in Can-Am or something. They made themselves up what they thought was a good-looking list. They knew where everyone had started, and then they made a lap chart that joined it all up. But I know my chart, the official chart, is complete nonsense.
Did Peter Dustin say anything about the result? No. To you, that is?
No. Judy always said she didn't think Peter really believed he won the race. But you know, history says he did, and that's the end of it.
Yeah. Now, how did you find Frank Williams as a person?
Frank, I'd known Frank since I was a mechanic on the Germany Formula Junior team, and Frank used to go around with Jonathan Williams, and I thought he was the only bloke who had less money than I had, and I had none. Then eventually Frank started wheeling and dealing, and so anyway, I'd known him all this time, and I rented some premises from him when I had my gearbox business. When I went to drive for him, he'd finally cracked it, you know, and he was off and away as a team owner. But unfortunately, there wasn't enough money, and I think Frank and I kind of drifted apart, having been quite good friends, and I used to go around to his house for dinner and stuff like that. Pity, really, you know, I had a 2-year contract with him, but at the end of the year, we sort of agreed that things weren't working too well. I think, really, that I didn't play it right, and Frank was being misled by somebody else.
Now, is it true, and I read this, so I have to ask you, that you lost the Williams drive for 74 as Marlboro wanted Arturo Mazzario in the car?
Well, they wanted an Italian driver in the second car, and when we left Watkins Glen, in theory, it was going to be Clay Regazzoni. But, of course, Clay, but as I knew, I don't think Frank knew at that point, because Frank was telling me, I think I can get Regazzoni. And I'd say, great, you know, I wanted a full-time teammate like that, because he'd had Jackie X at the Glen. He was always saying to me, oh, I'm going to get Jackie X. And I said, yeah, great. Well, yeah, the better other driver you get, the better it is for me. So, anyway, I knew that Clay was going to Ferrari, but I don't think for 74. And Mazzario was getting kicked out of Ferrari. And interesting, those two had a terrific battle at Watkins Glen that I could have got caught up in. They were banging wheels and cutting across curbs, and it was a bit of needle, obviously, between the two of them. Anyway, so it was going to be Mazzario in the second car, because I had a contract with Frank. But then, I don't know, they decided to do the rent-a-racer thing for the second car. Maybe there wasn't enough money, I don't know. It didn't matter to me, because I was gone.
You mentioned things did not work out, and we saw that happen not just with Frank, with other teams. And, you know, this guy Zanardi had a contract with Williams, things didn't work out. What really happened, apart from a money situation, what really goes on in a team between a driver and a team, that even if you have a 2 or a 3-year contract, that things don't work out? What is the missing link there?
I think in the case between Frank and I, there was a third party involved.
Can we get a name on this third party?
No, we can't.
Okay.
But, you know, people have their own axes to grind, don't they?
Sure.
And it's very easy to, if your car's not going fast enough, it's the driver's fault, isn't it? It's never the team, as it were, in whatever element you're looking there. And my defence, I suppose, was once we got the new cars, in some cases, very good co-drivers came along. And how many of them out-qualified me? Pescarola one time. X didn't, Schenken didn't, McRae didn't, and on like that. So why am I the scapegoat? for the car not going fast enough. I thought I knew how to improve the car immeasurably, but I was a bit of a voice in the wilderness. No, you're just not driving it fast enough. Well, okay. What about these other guys then? Well, never mind them. So you get into that, and then a relationship sours. But to this day, I do not blame Frank at all.
It's the third party.
The third party.
Okay. Now, you were driving for the Japanese Maki team when you had your serious leg injuries at German Grand Prix practice. Yeah. Looking back, do you think it was a mistake to go with an unproven team in the top echelon of motor racing?
Well, in hindsight, it was a bad mistake. But at the time, you see, I was driving for March, but their sponsorship hadn't materialized, except that Brambilla was standing there with his Beta Tools money. And so here I am, I have no sponsorship, I'm getting paid, and there's a guy who's pretty quick standing there with a pile of money. Well, I understood that Max and Robin would be forced, could be forced eventually, to say, oh, I'm sorry, but, you know. And then these guys, these Japanese people come along, and they say to me, we've got four cars and seven engines and two transporters and 55 mechanics, all the rest of it, you know, and we'll pay you a lot of money. Would you like to drive for us? And I say, yes, that's very nice. And who's the number two driver? Number two, just all you. Well, what am I going to do? Right. It was the old thing, if it sounds too good to be true, then it is. And it was. But having said that, having done a lot of testing and not got anywhere, I finally had a big shout up, and they did modify the car considerably before Brands. Unfortunately, they turned up a day too late. But I was thinking, this thing's starting to work now. And I was quite encouraged, and I was looking forward to Nürburgring. But of course, then when the suspension broke, that was the end of that.
Now, you know, I think that a racing driver's mentality is like a fighter pilot, that he's not going to get shot down, he's not going to have the accident. But when something like that happens to a driver, like it happened with you, do you just accept it, that, hey, it has happened to me now, or how did you cope with it?
Yeah, it's a fact of life. When I had the accident, realized how bad it was, and I thought I just had this, first off, complete numbness in my below my knees, and then the pain, and I thought, well, it'll wear off after a while. And I've got to be, there's a GPDA meeting after practice, and I hope I can still make it. And then, of course, when they x-rayed it, big problem here. And it's a fact of life, and I then didn't race for many months. In fact, my first proper race back was in May, the following May. The Grand Prix was in August, following May, I went back driving the Mirage for Jello with Tim Schenken. And I remember driving past the scene of the accident, first lap, and I looked at it, put it out of my mind, never thought about it again.
Looking back on your Formula One days, what do you cherish most, what memories, and what were some of the high points? You know, the highs are very high in motor racing, the lows are very low. So give us a rundown of a few of the things you think were really great and things that were not so great.
Well, there's usually not so great, so outweigh the great. Well, just getting into Formula One for a start, because that was my schoolboy dream, to get to Formula One, and I did. And then probably the first time I led a Grand Prix ever at Monza, although it's not unfortunately recorded officially, because the lead changed all around the circuit, so... Two or three times I was leading out of Lesmo too, but by the time you get to the start-finish line, I'm not in the lead, so it's never recorded it in the history as having led a Grand Prix. But anyway, about a run in the front bunch. Probably another highlight that nobody knows about, except me and a couple of others, is that at the British Grand Prix in 71, I had a puncture. That was a good race for me, and I stopped, and then I had to set off and try and catch up. And during that, unfortunately, didn't catch up enough to get in the points. I think I was seventh or eighth, but I made the second fastest lap of the race, just fractionally behind Jackie Stewart, who made the fastest lap. So I think, yeah, okay, you know, and I was in the old car. So things like that are little highlights. The Canadian Grand Prix, which it could be a highlight. The downs, yeah, the accident, clearly, with the Mackie. A few other things. Well, the Williams and the fuel system not working properly at Monza, disappointing, because I really loved the track. And when the engine ran, you know, it was looking pretty good, but then didn't run clean for a whole lap. So things like that are really disappointing.
Your favorite track? You have raced in South America also, basically all over the world. Your favorite tracks?
Well, I have a top three. I've always had a top three, and number one just is old Nürburgring. Just fantastic. It was very kind to me, and it was cruel to me, and I won the Eifelpokalrennen there in the BRM, and I did score points there in 72 in the BRM, and then, of course, had that huge accident in the Williams when the brake caliper fell off in 73, and then the Mackie accident in 74. So, and then I set a new 2-litre lap record there in 72. So it has its upsides, but it's just the most fantastic track. The next best for me is Spa, because it was so fast, and Corn Bernardville, and then being able to do the Master Kink flat and stuff like that. I thought that was fabulous. I recognise it was kind of stupidly dangerous, but of course you're immortal at that age. And then Monaco, because it rewards accuracy. If you are prepared to drive the car around there as though there are no AMCO barriers, or at least the edge of the road is just a curb like on a normal track, then you'll get a great reward from it. So I think that has to be. And of course, there is the atmosphere at Monaco. It's an unusual track, and its history as well. Look at the history of the place.
Do you have a list of bottom three tracks also, or places that you did not enjoy going to?
I never wanted to go to have an attitude that I didn't enjoy them. This is dead boring, or it's just not a nice track. But, what would I think was a track I really didn't enjoy? Well, I didn't think much of the short circuit at Buenos Aires, the Argentine Grand Prix 72. They ran on the short one. Later on, when the big circuit, you know, we're at 74 with March, I thought that was much different. That one in Belgium, Nivelles.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a shame. I mean, it's been a lot of money building a track, but it just wasn't much to it, really, was it? Not very much fun. What would be the next worst one? I'm trying to think. No, I can't really. Oh, no, Zolder was good. I quite liked Zolder. It was a little bit short, but it was I thought they slightly ruined it when they put the chicane in, because it used to be, you know, in Formula 5000 and Formula 2.
How about Jarama and Montjuic Park?
Oh, Monjuic was fantastic. Jarama was not terribly exciting.
You mentioned the 1972 Argentine Grand Prix. The man who started his career there in 1972 was on pole position. Yes. Carlos Reutemann, another of my favorites. Did you get to know him?
Well, I had known Carlos a little bit from when he was doing Formula 2, because that was the YPF team. And they came and rented a workshop from me that they operated out of.
Small world.
And so I'd got to know Carlos then when he was hanging around. And then I used to talk to him a bit when he came to Formula One. I wouldn't ever say I was a pretty good friend of his, but, you know, I knew him enough.
Alan Jones sure has some issues with him. I asked him, you know, they had this problem where Carlos would not slow down. So I asked Alan Jones, you know, how are things with him? He said, oh, everything is okay, press blew it up, but I won't have lunch with him. Will you have lunch with Lole?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. You are now vice president and on the board of BRDC, owner of Silverstone. What do you have to say about Bernie's bullying about taking the Grand Prix from Silverstone off from Britain, which will be, you know, pathetic?
Well, just to correct that, yes, I was a director of the BRDC for 9 years, and you're time barred after that. You can't do more than 9 years at one go. And after I then I was a director of Silverstone Circuits, and I was a director of Silverstone Estates, which are the two principal subsidiary companies of the BRDC. And I was the club secretary for a time, but then when my wife got ill, I had to resign from that position. And I'm delighted and so grateful that they made me a vice president, which is a great honour. Bernie and the Grand Prix, will he ever take it away? I don't know.
Well, you know, he has done a lot for motor racing. Has Bernie been good for Formula One lately?
Well, Bernie, you know, when he arrived, when he brought the Brabham team, Formula One was a bit of a shambles, wasn't it? There were championship races and there were non-championship races, so... And practice might start at 10 in the morning, but it might start at 11, and it'll start again at 2 o'clock, but maybe it won't because the officials are not back from lunch. Maybe it'll start at 3 o'clock, and then it would go on late, and then the poor old mechanics are going to work through the night. So Bernie brought order to some chaos, and he stopped the business with teams playing each other off against the organisers to get more start money. So, you know, Ferrari got more money and BRM perhaps got more money than some of the others. So Bernie tidied the whole thing up. So in that way, he's been really good for Formula One. And he made it the show it is, because it didn't have much television back then, you know, when he arrived, when I was in it. So, yeah, he can't criticise what Bernie's done in that respect. Whether he's done the right things in more recent years, I don't know. Time will tell. At the time that he arrived, perhaps we didn't realise how he was going to tidy it up, and you look back now and say, yeah, he did clean it all up.
Yeah. Your thoughts on the Spygate and the $100 million fine on McLaren, and as a former mechanic, driver, constructor, how much cheating and spying goes on in motor racing, and I'm sure this is not a 21st century thing.
No, I think it's always been there, and when I was a... Well, you know, I've had access to other cars. When I was doing Formula One, I've had access to other cars. You go along and measure the wheelbase and the airbox opening size and the wing height and all the rest of it. So, yeah, people have always done it. I regard it, when I got into the race car business myself, when I had Tiger Racing cars, I just recognised it was a hazard of the business. And I know that dimensions and things of my cars were pinched by other people, but so what? Move on. I don't know really how this McLaren thing got blown up, and because got to be careful what you say these days. Someone give you a slap. It's most odd that Renault supposedly weren't guilty, or that didn't warrant a fine, and McLaren's had $100 million. Seems a huge differential, doesn't there?
Now, last year, Lewis Hamilton had a 17-point lead in the championship with two races remaining. Now, as a former driver, who do you blame for that Shanghai surprise that he was left out on the shredded tires, the team or the driver?
I honestly don't know enough about that. But, the driver is the one who really knows what his tires look like, because he can see them. Only the team can see them a bit as they come by. I can't apportion blame, but you would have to wonder why the team didn't call him in. You know, if they thought, well, he reckons he can drive around there on that, in the tyres in that state, maybe he's wrong and we should call him in. But it goes deeper than that to me, and I'm not just saying this about Hamilton. I would say it about anybody, that you have to recognise that any circuit that's been wet gets a dry line quite quickly, because there are 22 cars going round and round and round on the same, more or less, the same line. But 22 cars are not coming down the pit lane every lap. So, of course, the pit lane is going to be much, much wetter, because it's maybe had one visit per car in X number of laps. So it doesn't get a dry line. And so I think you've got to say to yourself, I did, the pit lane is going to be slippery. I always thought they were in that situation. So you be careful.
Yeah. Alonso, man who beat Schumacher 2 years in a row, where did he go wrong in handling a fast teammate and his relationship with his team manager, Ron Dennis?
Where did he go? Well, I think if you have to recognize that you're going to get a teammate every so often who's going to be quicker than you, but there's no point taking it out on the team manager. Look to yourself.
Now, Lewis Hamilton, a lot of people are saying, you know, when he was on the podium first race, I said, well, you know, lucky break, good car, blah, blah, blah. You've seen him for a whole season like the rest of the world. Real deal or flash in the pan?
Oh, the real deal.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Raikkonen, a man of few words, and Michael Schumacher, a man of his own world. These people are not very willing to talk to the media like some other drivers. Do you think that hurts the image of Formula One or Formula One drivers?
Well, I think Formula One gets away with it being like that. It's quite interesting to contrast Formula One with, say, NASCAR or Indy, where the drivers mingle with the people and talk to them, and so they've got this huge fan base. Formula One seems not to have to do that, although perhaps it would help if they did. How much effect it has? I don't know. Until they all change, and when the Formula One drivers become like NASCAR drivers and talk to everybody and the crowds quadruple, then we'll know that was the answer.
Okay. Season coming up in Australia soon. Your thoughts on the 2008 season? Who do you think will be the main top dogs?
It's always the same guys, really, isn't it? It's sort of four teams, although Red Bull, of course, with Adrian having gone there, you know, they're coming into the equation now. McLaren will be there and Ferrari will be there, and the more people are able to do it, the longer you go on with a set formula, the more people learn to do it. It's like any act, you know, it's... There's a cross-pollination of ideas, and then drivers move, and they know what you got to do. And then, of course, freezing the engines and things like that brings it all closer together. But in the end, the same old guys usually come out on top. So it'll be interesting to see whether Red Bull can maintain the momentum that they've shown in testing, going quicker than Renault with the same engine.
Among the drivers who have not won a race, and we have a lot of talent coming through the system, who do you see as future racing star in Formula One?
Kovalainen, definitely. I was very surprised that Renault dropped him. I thought, you know, this guy's a superstar. Why? Well, what's going on here? But perhaps it was one of those things where Alonso didn't want teammate around his neck, and you can understand that. That's been done before. Senna did that at Lotus, didn't he? And and I guess Schumacher had the Ferrari situation well under control. so, yeah, other than Kovalainen, I thought Webber was struggling a bit in his career. Maybe he's having a second wind. You could see him winning a race.
You mentioned that if you're a driver, you have to realize sooner or later somebody's going to come into your team and be quicker than you. What should a driver, especially who is already established, do in a situation like that? How do you play that mind game?
I don't know. I was never in that fortunate position, but I think you just got to believe in yourself. And if you start in anything, no matter what it is, if you start getting upset at somebody coming in, sort of giving you a bit of hassle with whatever game you're playing, you're playing golf, your own performance is going to deteriorate. So put it out of your brain and get on and think, right, I've got to do a time, or I've got to hit my ball on the green or whatever, and just ignore the other guy.
Brendan Hartley is a young driver from your country, New Zealand, doing very well, and I've been following his career for a few years. Are you involved in his career or some other young New Zealand drivers?
No, I did. I was involved with the BIDC Young Driver Initiative funding program when it ran, but it was stopped. They are starting something similar up again, I believe. I have met Brendan. I've been made aware of him by Murray Taylor, and I organised a BIDC luncheon in Hamilton month or so, just before Christmas. And Brendan and his girlfriend came along, as two of the guests, and he got up and spoke. And interestingly, everybody else who got up and spoke, almost everyone, wished him the best. There's a lot of New Zealand following his career.
Yeah, I think he's a very good driver. What will it take to have a steady stream of American drivers in Formula One?
Americans tend to like to stay home. Perhaps it's a bit like the World Series, you know, that's only played in America, and there's a bit of that same mentality. We haven't seen any Americans, really. We had Scott Speed from the Red Bull thing, and prior to that, I guess it was Michael Andretti, and the last one who really made it, well, Mario, but then he was born in Europe, so he travelled more easily, I think. And then Revy. It appears to me the Americans don't like to go out of their own country. You know, it's an alien culture, in a way, to go to Europe. And certainly it used to be, there were a few of them doing Formula 3 when I was doing it, but they, and actually the Kiwis a little bit the same, they all seem to get homesick and want to go home. But before they cracked it, I thought you had to stay and battle it out. So that's what I have attributed to the lack of American Formula One drivers, and they can make a very nice living running at home, driving in NASCAR or IRL or Champ Car or whatever.
Red Bull program is now discontinued. Do you think it was the program had good intention, or was it handled properly?
Well, I'm sure with Helmut Marko running it, it was handled very well, and it it did uncover some talent, didn't it? And so any program like that is good, because how else can a young guy get up there? I mean, the money that you have to find today is just ridiculous, really. That and so many young guys are denied opportunities. So whether it's the BRDC or Red Bull or whoever it is, anything like that's got to be great for racing.
Anything else, any advice you would give to young guys who are trying to get into racing, who are already in like junior level? You know, things have changed so much in the last 30 years. What advice or guidance will you give?
Never give up.
That's good. Okay, finally, how about a message for listeners of our podcast, please?
Well, thank you all for listening. I hope you've found what I have to say interesting. Motor racing has been very good to me. I've been involved in it for my whole life, since that day in January 1955 at Ardmore, and it's just a wonderful sport, and I suppose I'll be involved with it for the rest of my life. And you're obviously all enthusiasts as well, or you wouldn't be listening. So good luck to you all.
If I may ask, what kind of involvement do you have these days in motor racing, both here and overseas?
Well, my only real involvement now is just as being a vice president of the BRDC, and I try to go to as many functions of theirs as I can. I was at the Savoy for the annual award ceremony, where Lewis Hamilton came and collected his prizes. And then I was at another BRDC lunch more recently. And so, yeah, and I follow it. I look on the websites every day. I go on Atlas F1, the autosport.com website, as much as anything to look at the Judy Ganley thread on the Nostalgia Forum, but I also follow what's happening in Formula One and the gossip and in the other areas as well, because I follow Andy Priot's career. Andy was one of the first young guys that we funded in the BRDC Young Driver Initiative, and I always like to follow Justin Wilson because he was another one. So I'm not turning my back on it by any means.
No, we need more racing fans here. I know you never raced in Champ Cars. This unification thing, the split, how do you look at it?
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it? There's quite a lot of money in both, but not quite enough. And it's hard to see. You look at what IRL have achieved, and they've got Indianapolis, and it's a great show. And at the same time, you talk to Kevin Kalkhoven, and he's done a terrific job with Champ Car, and I think he's got a great package, but somehow won't work in isolation either, or not won't work as well as it should. So Yeah, I mean, it looked for a time as though the two of them might survive very nicely by themselves, but I suppose, you know, with the world economy, it's becoming more and more difficult. So it'd be lovely to see a solution to the problem.
When you were racing, did you have any desire to be at Indy 500?
Yes, I went to Indianapolis. Ian Young organized for me to go to first qualifying weekend in 1973. And I hadn't gone with the idea of doing anything particularly, but then I started meeting car owners and things, and then it looked as though the Belgian Grand Prix, which was being held at Zolder that year, was maybe going to be cancelled. So, tentatively, I was going to then attempt to qualify a car on second qualifying weekend. So, but then I got the call from Frank that the Grand Prix's on again, so I come home. So that was the end of that. However, Teddy Mayer did say to me, look, if you're going to do this, you need to be in one of Gurney's cars or one of ours. Don't go anywhere else because you're likely to hurt yourself and you won't look good. And so I did never pursue it after that.
One more question about a very quick Kiwi who unfortunately pretty much had the same fate as Chris Heyman, Mike Tagwell. Do you know him? What is he up to these days?
Well, I read about Mike occasionally on the Nostalgia Forum. Obviously, I know his sister. I know he's married to David Bram, Lisa. I know his father knew him. Well, of course, I'd met Mike, when he was doing Formula Ford and stuff like that. And there was a really talented guy, and he was, driving for Sauber in the sports cars, and just as Mercedes really stepped in, Mike stepped out, which is, he could have a very lucrative career, but he obviously has done what he wants to do. There was a wasted talent.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Very nice talking to you.
Howden Genley, thank you very much for joining F1Weekly.com.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs. We'll be right back.